He was the rebel the world couldn't tame, the prophet they couldn't package, the man who sang not for charts, but for change. This is not the Bob Marley story. This is the other voice, the one they tried to silence. From the hills of Westmoreland to the halls of revolution, from bullets to prophecy, Peter Tosh never bowed. He burned. This is his truth. Uncut, unapologetic, undeniable. This is Peter Tosh, voice of the fire, the untold story. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Peter Tosh, A Journey Through Time, Episode 3. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 9, Banned and Beaten. There are moments when a man becomes more than flesh. When his voice becomes a threat, his existence a rebellion. For Peter Tosh, that transformation came not with applause, but with blood. With fists and batons, with censorship and exile, because for all his music, his truth, his fire, Jamaica's most dangerous man wasn't holding a gun, he was holding a mic, and Babylon decided it was time to break him. By the late 1970s, Peter was no longer just a controversial artist. He was a marked man. His albums, from Legalize It to Equal Rights and Mystic Man, had struck nerves, deep ones. His messages weren't sugar-coated for radio. They weren't designed for tourists. They were for the sufferers, for the youth burning under colonial hangovers and economic oppression, for the Rastas still being arrested, shaved, brutalized by police who saw dreadlocks as rebellion and ganja as heresy. Peter had become too bold, too direct, too free. And the state, the very Babylon he'd chanted against in every verse, was listening. They watched him, shadowed him, documented his lyrics as subversion. Then they came for him. It happened on September 11th, 1978. The air was thick that night. Peter had been performing with his band at a Kingston venue. The crowd was electric, feverish, caught in the wave of his righteous fury. He had given them his usual sermon mid-performance, calling out police brutality, government corruption, the hypocrisy of so-called peace, politicians who let poverty flourish while driving luxury cars through ghettos of barefoot children. He knew they were listening. He wanted them to listen. After the show, he and several members of his band headed back toward Halfway Tree, the heart of Kingston's commercial district. It was near the Coronation Market that it happened. Sirens, screeching tires, shouting, then chaos. Jamaican police stormed them, guns drawn, nightsticks swinging, accusations flying. Peter tried to reason. He asked for clarity. Why were they being stopped? What law had been broken? But there was no reason, only rage. They dragged him from the car, beat him to the pavement, kicked him in the ribs, slammed his head against the sidewalk. Over and over, in front of everyone, his bandmates screamed. Some tried to intervene. They were beaten too. No camera crews. No justice. Just concrete and blood. Peter's skull was fractured. His ribs bruised. He had to be carried to the hospital, where he lay for days, barely conscious, his dreadlocks soaked in dried blood. The man who had marched through Europe, who had stood in African capitals as a hero, now lay in a Kingston hospital bed treated like a criminal for daring to speak. The official charge? Disorderly conduct. Resisting arrest. Loitering. A lie. A message. Stay silent or suffer. But Peter didn't stay silent. He spoke from the hospital bed, gave interviews with bandages wrapped around his forehead, showed his bruises to the press, called out the officers by name, demanded answers, accused the Jamaican government of orchestrating the attack. I was beaten for the truth, he said. Them beat me because I don't sing pretty lies. But me nah bow. His fans were outraged. But the institutions? They remained quiet. No officer was charged. No apology given. Instead, the doors began to close. Radio stations, already reluctant, stopped playing his songs entirely. Promoters were pressured not to book him. Television interviews were canceled at the last minute. Newspapers mocked him as paranoid, and when he tried to organize his own concerts, permits were denied. Security was unavailable. Peter had become unplayable, unwelcomed, unmanageable, but never untrue. He returned to the stage as soon as he could walk unaided. His first show back was less a concert and more a declaration of survival. Dressed in black, sunglasses covering his healing eyes, he stood before the crowd and said, "Dem tink me woulda dead, but Jah live. And me live." And then he played Stepping Razor. The crowd erupted. because they knew this man was no longer just singing. He was bleeding truth into every verse. Every lyric had weight. Every chorus carried scars. The government couldn't kill his voice, so they tried to erase it. They tightened the net. His albums were denied airplay not only in Jamaica, but in Caribbean territories where conservative leadership labeled him a threat to national values. In Trinidad, officials warned that his music encouraged anti-establishment sentiment. In Barbados, entire broadcasts were pulled when DJs played his tracks. He was being scrubbed, not for violence, not for hate, but for truth. Meanwhile, Peter grew even more radical. If they were going to ban him, then he'd become unbannable. He started producing his own tapes, his own street pressings, handing them out at protests and gatherings. He performed in underground venues, street corners, schools, and ghettos. His message didn't soften. It hardened. "Babylon, fear me," he said once, "because I show people they don't have to beg. They can take their rights back." And he began naming names. He called out Edward Seega, Michael Manley, foreign diplomats, religious leaders, even international record executives. He accused everyone complicit in systemic inequality. He told the Pope to go to hell. He mocked the Queen of England. He warned the CIA. And he did it publicly. Many thought he was inviting death. But Peter didn't fear it. He had already faced it. In the back of a police van, in the bruises on his ribs, in the cold shoulder of an industry that had once pretended to embrace him. He'd walked through that valley, and now he feared only one thing. Silence. In 1981, when Bob Marley passed, the world mourned. Bob was celebrated, televised, sanctified. Peter mourned too. Bob had been his brother, his mirror. But the world's adoration of Bob only deepened Peter's isolation. He watched as the global industry that once feared reggae now polished it for Western comfort. Marley's image was everywhere. But where was the revolution? Where was the fire? Peter spoke out even in grief. "Dem love Bob now cause him dead. But when we were chanting truth together, they tried to kill us. Remember that." And so Peter doubled down. He began crafting his most militant, most spiritually charged work. He poured his agony into lyrics, his scars into bass lines. He recorded with intensity, pushing his musicians to play not like entertainers, but like soldiers. But the industry didn't know what to do with him. Labels turned him away. Even Island Records, which had once distributed his work, began to distance itself. He refused to be managed, to be packaged. He wouldn't tour unless the security was fair. He demanded ganja rights at every venue. He insulted police at press conferences. He wouldn't be silenced, but he would be sidelined. And yet, the people never forgot. In the ghettos, in the bush, in the back alleys and quiet corners, Peter Tosh remained a prophet. His face on murals, his voice on bootlegs, his message passed from youth to youth, because they knew the truth. He had been banned. He had been beaten. Chapter 10, Rasta International. There comes a time when the words of a prophet grow too large for the soil that birthed them, when the air becomes too thick with censorship, when the walls of the homeland begin to close in, choking the voice that once echoed through its hills. For Peter Tosh, that time had come. Jamaica, his crucible, had given him rhythm and roots, but it had also given him bruises and betrayal. The beatings, the bans, the closed doors, it was all part of the cost. But Peter wasn't the kind of man to wait for the gatekeepers to offer an invitation. So he kicked down the gates and carried his message international. He wasn't seeking fame. He was seeking amplification, a wider battlefield, and the world was listening. In Europe, especially in places like Germany, the Netherlands, France, and the UK, Peter was greeted not as an outlier, but as a revolutionary. These were nations steeped in their own resistance histories, anti-fascist, anti-colonial, anti-imperial. And when Peter landed with his dreadlocks, his military garb, and his unfiltered truth, they recognized a kindred fire. He played in massive open-air festivals, Reggae Sunsplash Europe, Rock Palace, Montreux Jazz Festival, where tens of thousands gathered not just to dance, but to witness. Because Peter didn't perform. He testified. He turned stadiums into pulpits, sound systems into sermons. Between songs, he'd speak on African unity, on economic injustice, on the perils of capitalism, and the betrayal of African nations by neocolonialism. He'd stand on those stages, staring into foreign faces, and say things they'd never heard from a musician before. "I come not to sing for your amusement. I come to liberate your mind." And that he did. In Amsterdam, his advocacy for marijuana reform struck deep. There, where tolerance policies were blooming, Peter wasn't a criminal, he was a prophet. He met with local activists, walked through coffee shops like royalty, and debated legal scholars on national television. His arguments weren't stoner cliches. He cited history, agriculture, medicine. He framed ganja not as escapism, but as spiritual clarity. In Italy, he performed in front of cathedrals and turned his gaze on the church itself. Christ was black, he'd declare, and dem bleach him in every Bible on your shelf. Crowds gasped. Priests clutched rosaries. But Peter never flinched. He was not there to be palatable. He was there to provoke awakening. In London, where West Indian immigrants still faced racism and poverty, Peter became a rallying cry. British youth, black, brown, white, and working class, lined the streets, blasted his music from tower block windows, painted his lyrics on walls. To them, he wasn't a Jamaican export. He was truth in human form. But nowhere did Peter's words resonate more deeply than across the Atlantic, in the heart of Mother Africa. Africa wasn't a destination for Peter. It was home. The blood in his veins, the compass in his lyrics, the drumbeat in his chest. And when he arrived on African soil, it wasn't for spectacle, it was for reconnection. In Nigeria, Ghana, and Senegal, he was received like royalty. Local leaders greeted him with reverence. Elders clasped his hands. Rasta brethren wept openly in his presence. For many Africans, Peter Tosh was the echo of something ancient. A warrior they had lost to the ships, but now saw returned. A son stolen, now speaking for them on global stages. He played in Accra before a sea of faces. No light shows. No flashy costumes. Just Peter, a guitar, and the word of Jah. And when he sang African, the people sang it back, not just in English, but in their mother tongues. They knew the truth he carried, that the diaspora had not forgotten, and neither had the motherland. Peter toured university campuses, met with professors, debated government officials. He challenged African presidents to reject Western loans and build continental coalitions. "Don't sell your soul for IMF breadcrumbs," he warned. "The same ones who stole your children now want to buy your future." He spoke of Pan-Africanism with Garveyite fire, advocated for African languages to replace colonial tongues in education, questioned why African youth still wore European uniforms in school. "Your mind can't be free if your mirror still tell you ugly," he said. And he wasn't just welcomed by the people. He inspired action. In Zimbabwe, Peter was invited to perform at the country's official independence celebration in 1980. It was a milestone moment, a nation rising from the ashes of colonial Rhodesia, a black majority finally holding power. The world watched as Peter took the stage, before Robert Mugabe, foreign dignitaries, soldiers, elders, and children. The energy was electric. He opened with Equal Rights, then African, and finally he played Get Up, Stand Up. 100,000 voices rose with him. It wasn't just a concert. It was liberation in sound waves. And for a fleeting moment, the dream of Pan-African freedom felt tangible. But even in his triumphs abroad, Peter never let the Western world off the hook. In the United States, he delivered what would become one of the most unforgettable moments in music protest history, the 1979 One Love Peace concert in Kingston. He took the stage with no permission, no invitation to speak, but he did. In front of 30,000 people, including Prime Minister Michael Manley and opposition leader Edward Sega, he unleashed a 10-minute verbal assault. With a spliff in hand and fury in his eyes, Peter called out the politicians for their lies, for their neglect of the poor, for their role in Jamaica's bloodshed. He accused them of playing political games while youth starved and gangs killed. And when he turned to the police, those who had beaten him nearly to death, he said, "I am not afraid of you. You are not my God. You have no power over truth." The crowd erupted. The cameras shook. The system froze. No other artist had ever done that. Peter wasn't just a musician anymore. He was a movement, a living contradiction to every lie the world had been told about black men, about Rastas, about rebels, about Africans. And it terrified Babylon. He was denied visas, banned from radio, excluded from Grammy nominations, marginalized in the very genre he helped elevate. Even as Bob Marley became reggae's global face, Peter remained its soul. Unpackaged, untamed, unapologetic. But Peter didn't need the music industry. He had people, all over the world. From Kingston to Amsterdam, from Lagos to London, from Addis Ababa to Brooklyn, they painted his face on walls. They tattooed his lyrics on skin. They played his music underground, in protests, in classrooms, in prisons. His words became scripture for those who had been forgotten by systems, for those who wanted not just to survive, but to rise. Peter Tosh had become what no industry could contain, a Rasta international, a prophet in exile, a warrior for the world. Chapter 11, Peter versus the industry. There are artists who bend to fit the mold. Then there are artists who break the mold and are punished for it. And then there is Peter Tosh. He didn't just refuse to bend. He set the mold on fire and walked away. By the time he had risen from his bloodstained hospital bed, delivered thunderous sermons on global stages, and carried the message of Rasta and revolution across continents, Peter Tosh was no longer just an artist. He was a phenomenon, a threat to any system that demanded silence, dilution, or submission. And no system was more uncomfortable with Peter's defiance than the music industry itself. Because Peter didn't play the game, and the game never forgave him for that. From the beginning, his relationship with the music business had been rocky, distrustful, and often downright hostile. Unlike Bob Marley, who despite his own struggles had found a strange, careful equilibrium within the corporate machine, Peter rejected that balance. He didn't want compromise. He didn't want marketing departments softening his message for suburban buyers. He didn't want studio executives trimming verses to make his music more radio-friendly. He wanted the raw, undiluted truth to be delivered to the people, whether it sold or not. That terrified the gatekeepers. They couldn't predict him. They couldn't control him. And worst of all, they couldn't silence him. His battles began with Island Records and Chris Blackwell, the man who had helped turn Bob Marley into a global icon. To Peter, Blackwell was not a savior of reggae. He was Babylon in a suit, an aristocratic white Jamaican profiting off the voice of the oppressed. Peter often accused him of playing divide and conquer among the Wailers, of promoting Bob as the sole face of the revolution while sidelining the other two founding voices. When Peter went solo, he made it clear, he didn't want handouts. He wanted fairness. But fairness was a myth in an industry built on exploitation. Recording contracts were filled with legal traps, recoupment clauses, royalty loopholes, fine print that gave corporations full control over an artist's catalog and image. Peter read every line, questioned every term, argued in boardrooms, walked out of meetings, refused to sign unless changes were made. Most executives weren't used to that, especially not from a barefoot, dreadlocked Rasta with no lawyer by his side. But Peter didn't need a legal team. He had clarity, and that made him dangerous. He signed with CBS Records in the late 1970s, lured by promises of creative freedom. But the honeymoon didn't last. Soon, the same pressures returned. Executives wanted cleaner production, less politics, more radio hits. They wanted another Marley. Peter gave them Bush Doctor, an album that featured Rolling Stones guitarist Mick Jagger on You Gotta Walk, Don't Look Back. The industry finally saw a crack they could exploit. Peter had star power. He had international appeal. He had rock and roll cosigns. Maybe, just maybe, they thought they could package him, sand down the sharp edges, sell him to a mainstream audience. But Peter only played the game long enough to expose its lies. The moment he realized they were trying to use Jagger's name to overshadow his message, he pulled back. He didn't want fame built on another man's image. He wanted to stand on his own words, and those words were not for sale. From then on, his war with the industry escalated. He gave interviews eviscerating the system. He accused labels of robbing black artists, of colonial theft wrapped in record deals. He refused to attend promotional events. He clashed with managers, canceled tours when contracts weren't honored, refused photo shoots unless he could wear what he wanted, military fatigues, Rasta robes, nothing polished for Western eyes. They tried to rebrand him. He unbranded himself. When they tried to define reggae as island music, Peter barked, "Reggae is the suffering of the people put to rhythm. Don't you dare call it a vacation soundtrack." He rejected stylists, rejected stylized biographies, rejected the term entertainer. "I am not here to entertain you," he'd say. "I am here to liberate you." And this wasn't posturing. It was purpose, because Peter understood the game. He saw how the industry loved the image of rebellion, but not its reality. How they would turn a freedom fighter into a poster boy, strip away the message, then sell the shell. He saw how they adored Bob Marley once he was dead, but were terrified of his living truth. Peter refused to become that corpse. So the industry responded in the only way it knew how. They erased him. He was removed from playlists, excluded from awards. His album reviews were buried, even when the music was brilliant. Critics labeled him too angry, too paranoid, too radical. He was blamed for his own marginalization, as if his refusal to compromise were a flaw, not a virtue. But Peter didn't flinch. He started pressing his own records, booking his own tours, selling tapes hand to hand, performing anywhere that would have him, rural towns, college campuses, underground clubs. He wasn't a celebrity. He was a messenger, and he would keep walking, even if he walked alone. The industry offered him a seat at the table if he kept his mouth shut. Peter flipped the table instead. In one infamous interview, when asked why he thought the industry wouldn't support him, Peter stared straight into the camera and said, "Because me too truthful. Me too dread. Me too real for dem fantasy. Babylon want Rasta to smile and dance. Me come fi burn it down." And burn he did. His later albums, Wanted Dread and Alive, No Nuclear War, were unapologetically revolutionary. He tackled apartheid, police murder, imperialism, religious hypocrisy, and nuclear proliferation. His voice had matured, not in tone, but in depth. There was weariness in his eyes, scars in his voice, but the fire remained. Each release became more independent, each show more urgent, each word more sacred, because Peter understood that freedom, true, unfiltered freedom, would never be handed to him. Not by the state, not by religion, and certainly not by the music industry. He would have to take it. And so he became the very thing the industry feared most, an artist they could not own. Chapter 12, A Soul in Exile. Peter Tosh was still alive, but the world had begun treating him like he was already gone. He had once stood on global stages, echoing truth across continents, his voice thunderous and unwavering. But by the early 1980s, the volume of the crowds had dulled. The media had moved on. The industry had closed its doors. Even many of his contemporaries, those who once rallied to the rhythm of resistance, had found quieter lives, softer corners, safer messages. But Peter wasn't built for retreat. He didn't shrink or mellow with age. He burned deeper. And when the world turned its back on him, he turned inward, into the bush, into his books, into long sessions of meditation and reasoning, into the stillness where prophets go when the storm refuses to listen. He had become a soul in exile, not just from Jamaica, not just from the industry, but from the culture that once called him brother, then looked away when the bullets came, when the bruises swelled, when the silence grew thick. In truth, Peter had always existed outside the margins. Even in his youth, even at the height of the Wailers, he was the uninvited voice, the one too raw, too serious, too bold. But now, that alienation had matured. It had calcified into something heavier. He had been banned from radio, locked out of mainstream press, and stripped of major label support. And so, he lived like a spiritual warrior in self-imposed exile, less seen, but more aware than ever before. He moved back into the hills above Kingston, surrounding himself with nature, dreadlocked brethren, and a fortress of ideas. His home was both a sanctuary and a front line, a place where drums still beat at night, where chalices burned in rhythm with Nyabingi chants, and where no Babylonian breath could pollute the frequency of truth. There he wrote, feverishly. He filled notebooks with lyrics, manifestos, critiques, and visions. Pages and pages of prophecy, warning, scripture. Songs he would never record. Thoughts too dense for industry ears. Some were poetic. Others were rageful. Some sounded like sermons. Others read like battle plans. He wrote not to be heard, but because he had to. Because silence, for Peter Tosh, had always been the final sin. And he studied books on African philosophy, herbal medicine, quantum mechanics, biblical numerology, ancient Egyptian cosmology. He was obsessed with decoding systems, spiritual, scientific, political. He didn't separate them. To him, they were all connected. The body, the earth, the spirit, the state, each one a battlefield where Babylon operated through distraction and distortion. His understanding of Rasta deepened. No longer merely a cultural identity, it became for Peter a full cosmological framework. He began to speak of dimensions, frequencies, sacred geometry. He told those who visited that we are not bodies having spiritual experiences, but spirits passing through a corrupted dimension. Babylon, he would say, was not just governments. It was illusion itself. And reggae was not entertainment, it was a portal. But while his mysticism expanded, so too did his isolation. Friends faded away. Collaborators moved on. Some said he had become paranoid. Others said he was unapproachable. But the truth was more nuanced. Peter had grown tired, not physically, but spiritually. Tired of fighting a war the world pretended didn't exist. Tired of warning a people who were too seduced by illusion to hear him. Even his own community sometimes questioned him. Youths who once saw him as a giant now looked to newer stars. Rastas debated his methods. Politicians labeled him erratic. Even among the poor, some whispered he was too far gone, that he'd crossed some invisible line between rebel and madman. But Peter never begged for validation. He'd seen what fame cost. He watched as Bob Marley's image was polished and packaged, turned into a brand while his messages were trimmed to fit corporate campaigns. He knew what the world did to prophets. It crucified them first, then sold their images like souvenirs. He didn't want that fate, so he stepped out of the spotlight entirely. Still, music pulsed through him. He continued to record, though at a slower pace, with fewer resources. The studio had become less a commercial endeavor and more a place of sacred labor. Every song was layered in intention, every note a spell. He didn't record for charts, he recorded for eternity. In 1983, he released Mama Africa, a deeply personal album that paid homage to the motherland and reflected the pain of separation felt by generations of the diaspora. It wasn't a commercial hit, but it resonated with those who still listened closely. The title track, Mama Africa, was less a song than a homecoming prayer, a yearning set to rhythm, wrapped in ancestral longing. But even this album came and went without the recognition it deserved. Peter saw it for what it was, evidence that truth had lost its currency in a world of deception. He grew more guarded, more selective. Visitors to his home were vetted carefully. Interviews were rare. When he did speak publicly, he spoke with a fire that seemed even more urgent than in his youth. He knew time was short, not because he was sick, but because he was watched. He often spoke of people trailing him, cars idling outside his home, strange phone calls. He believed Babylon still had him marked. Many called it paranoia, but Peter had been beaten, had been censored, had been betrayed. The system didn't have to kill you to silence you. It just had to erase your relevance. And yet, through all of it, through the silence, the solitude, the suspicion, Peter remained faithful to his God, to his people, to his cause. He still opened his doors to young musicians, still gave advice to grassroots organizers, still reasoned with brethren under the stars about what was to come. He believed the final battle wasn't between political parties or armies. It was between consciousness and illusion, between those who saw and those who slept. And in this battle, he would not abandon his post. He was no longer a pop star. He was a guardian of vibration. He didn't need millions of followers, just a few awakened souls who could carry the torch. His mission was never to be liked. It was to be true. And if the world would not celebrate that, so be it. He lived on little. He traveled less. He stayed in the hills, wrapped in silence, wrapped in smoke, wrapped in prayer. But inside that quiet, a storm still raged. Because Peter knew what was coming. And he was preparing, not for applause, but for war.